Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for episode 21, Tragedy in Visalia. Tonight, we're on the case in Visalia, California. The growing farming region became the unlikely backdrop for every parent's worst nightmare when 10-year-old Vicky Ramirez vanished in a crowded market. As police launched a desperate search to find the young girl, all her family could do was pray that somehow she would be brought home safe and sound. March 3rd, 1994. It was 12:40 on a typical Thursday afternoon when a frightened mother of four contacted the Tulare County Sheriff's Department. Detective Josh Lowry.
Angelica Ramirez had called the sheriff's department to report her daughter missing from the Visalia SWAT.
It had been several hours since the last time anyone had seen her.
She was last seen around 9:40 in the morning when she had told her mom that she was going to go use one of the public restrooms. They had searched the SWAT mate grounds themselves before calling us.
It appeared that 10-year-old Vicky had vanished while her mother was running a booth just steps away. Sergeant John Bennis.
It was a very crowded location.
Detective Mike Boudreau.
All types of items are sold there. It's a lot of hustle and bustle. There was easily 1,000 or more people there that day.
Angelica and Vicky's younger sister, Michaela, told police how the terrifying morning unfolded. Vicky's sister, Michaela Pace.
My mom was getting us ready to go to school. I threw a fit because I wanted to go to the swap meet. And because of me, we ended up going to the swap meet when we weren't supposed to go.
The decision still haunts Michaela almost 30 years later.
Every day it relives in my mind. I've always felt guilty for wanting to go with my mom. Guilt has just made me relive that day over and over.
For Michaela, Vicky, and their two other siblings, that nightmarish morning had started off as a dream come true. The swap meet was filled with interesting people and exciting times.
My mom and her then husband were busy with customers coming in. Our younger brother, Javier, he was about a year, and we were walking around with the stroller, just exploring.
When they got back to their mom's booth, Vicky said she had to use the bathroom.
She asked my mom, "Mom, can I go to the restroom by myself?"
It was a sign of the times and the safe family atmosphere at the swap meet that led Angelica to say yes without hesitation.
The bathroom wasn't too far away either, so my mom allowed her to go.
But as the minutes went by and Vicky hadn't returned, Michaela began to feel uneasy.
I had asked my mom, "Mom, where's Vicky?" And she's like, "She went to the bathroom." "Well, she's not back yet." I was scared.
Angelica sprang into action, immediately checking the restroom. Vicky's mother, Angelica Ramirez.
I went to the bathroom, I was screaming, "Vicky, where are you? Vicky, where are you?" And I was crying because I didn't see her. And there was a lady, and she go, "Hey, man, why are you crying?" I go, "I'm looking for my daughter. Have you seen my daughter?" And she go, "Yeah, your daughter was here." She go, "Oh, don't worry, she's in the bathroom. Go check, make sure she should be in there because she was behind me when I was here in line."
She went, and she didn't find her in there.
Michaela can still remember the panicked look on her mother's face when she returned.
She came back frantic, and I guess I freaked out because my mom was distraught and worried.
From that moment on, chaos ensued.
I was screaming everywhere, calling everyone for help.
She was just saying, hey, I can't find Vicky. Help me find Vicky. Let's find Vicky. Where's Vicky? People that were just nearby bystanders or buying stuff from the stand were like, oh, what did she look like? Where did she go? Where can we help?
Dozens of people joined in to help search for the 10-year-old. But it quickly became clear that finding Vicky in the massive space was a job for law enforcement. Friends' attempts to help Angelica calm down were in vain as she anxiously waited for police to arrive.
Everyone, all my family was my friends. They would say, don't cry, Angie. She will be over there. Maybe she's in some place.
But Michaela's mother's intuition led her to believe that something was terribly wrong.
I was very scared because the first thing I was thinking, hey, what happened to my daughter? How did this happen?
They had called the cops. It seemed like a lifetime from them arriving there. And I was scared of where she could have gone. I remember my mom sitting down and crying and saying, we need to find her, we need to find her.
When police arrived, they quickly sprang into action. Officers gathered details about the missing 10-year-old. Michaela helped describe what she was wearing to police.
I remember it like it was yesterday. She had her hair up in a ponytail. She was wearing this white shirt with a palm tree and a cat that said Cool Cat. She was wearing a black skirt and then some black shoes.
Investigators weaved through the crowds, but there was little they could do to lock down the open-air market.
You have to picture there's hundreds of people wandering around the swap meet.
We needed to go booth by booth and building by building. I just wanted to make sure that every square inch was searched.
As the search got underway, investigators were confident they were going to find the missing 10-year-old.
The shock wasn't extreme at that point. We just had a missing young girl. That occurs quite regularly. We'll have someone who walks or goes to a family friend's house and they didn't tell their mom they were going, or they'll wander off with a friend at the swap meet and then we eventually find them.
He thought the chances that Vicky had gone off with a friend were extremely high.
Honestly, what I felt was that we were going to find her. I felt that those scenarios that we often replay of missing children that have wandered off with a friend or have gotten in an argument with a mom and they wander off intentionally, one of those scenarios was going to come into play. And so my job as an investigator was to eliminate all those possibilities. And we began to quickly eliminate that.
Police found many people who had seen Vicky that morning, but no one had noticed her after she left the restroom. As time went on with no signs of Vicky, they started to believe that the young girl might be in trouble.
We could feel the panic. We knew that she was nowhere on the premises. We had checked every booth. We had searched everywhere. I knew something wasn't right. Nothing was adding up.
Investigators called in a specially trained canine team to help.
The sheriff's canine team tracked Vicky's scent from the bathrooms through the swap meet grounds to the parking lot.
We knew what she was wearing was a young girl's shoe with a tight, sharp heel to it. And we could see the small foot pattern walking out into this parking lot. And then there's some tire tracks. That's when I panicked. That's when I knew she, in fact, had left the perimeter of the swap meet and had been abducted.
It was a stunning revelation, and the investigators on the scene knew that time was of the essence. And based on the shoe impressions found in the parking lot, detectives believed that Vicky had known whoever had taken her.
Someone had gained her trust to walk her out into this parking lot, so my theory was it had to be someone she knew.
Just hours after 10-year-old Vicky Ramirez vanished from a crowded swap meet, her family was in a state of panic.
The swap meet had emptied out. The vendors had left.
Detectives instructed the family to go home and wait for further news.
We went back to our house. And we were just scared and wondering, talking about where could Victoria be? Where could Vicky be? Where'd she gone? And hearing my mom cry in the other room, just sobbing with so much pain of not knowing where my sister was.
For Michaela, Vicky had been much more than just a big sister.
My sister was so special, so loving. She was like my second mom. She imitated everything that my mom would do. She was like, here, I'll do your hair. Oh, you're hungry? I'll make you something. On Sunday, she would read the Bible to us.
She was a wonderful daughter, very sweet. She didn't like me to be sad. If she see me sad, she was going to me and give me a hug and a kiss. Say, Mom, everything gonna be okay. She was very sweet.
And Vicky took pride in being her mother's number one helper around the house.
She was very responsible. She used to cook, clean, and help him with anything.
Vicky's maturity, intelligence, and deep connection to her family made it hard for police to understand how someone could have abducted her from the swap meet parking lot.
My theory was she knew this person, but we began eliminating potential suspects relatively quickly. Uncles and family members and friends who all had verifiable, reliable alibis.
Once everyone close to Vicky had been eliminated, detectives had to look elsewhere.
Then we began to theorize, could this be a stranger abduction?
I know my sister was very helpful. When we were in school, she was always helping others and little kids. And just the only way that I can think of her going with someone is someone had told her, hey, we need some help. That's the only way that I can think of.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. As word spread about Vicky's disappearance, people who had left the swap meet before officers arrived began to call in about something that now seemed disturbing. Detective Josh Lowry.
There were several people that saw someone carrying a kid that was screaming and crying. She was a similar age, build, and appearance to Vicky.
And the witnesses also got a look at the car the potential abductor had fled in.
Several people had observed a blue Isuzu leaving the swap meet at a high rate of speed, swerving in and out of traffic, passing cars, driving recklessly.
During the driver's dangerous high-speed departure, one witness saw a young girl in the back seat.
She was cowering in the back of this Isuzu. And it appeared that the child was in distress.
The witness also provided critical details about the man behind the wheel and the woman who had helped him control the child.
The driver was a Hispanic male with a ponytail, and there was a Hispanic female adult yelling at the child.
And the witness provided another critical clue about the car.
There was a for sale sign on the side of the Isuzu.
Detectives believed if they could locate the couple or their blue car, it might lead to the missing fourth grader.
The sheriff's department had put out a press release with these two composite sketches of the male and the female with a description of the blue Isuzu.
The sheriff's department dedicated all their resources to finding Vicky. Detective Mike Boudreau.
We already have an airplane up. The airplane is searching the area for anything that would remotely give us a clue that would lead us in some direction. We had multiple ground searchers. We had close to 60 detectives that were out. We began going door to door of houses in the area.
Sergeant John Bennis.
You're always hopeful that you're going to have a successful search for a missing child.
The clock was ticking, and they knew the more time that passed, the less likely it would be to find her alive.
We've set up command staff. We've set up communication efforts outside our normal patrol communication efforts. We have a search and rescue team here with Trailer County, one of the best in the nation, known for its search and rescue efforts. That team was called in. Other canines were called in. Trackers were called in.
Then, 48 hours after Vicky's disappearance, police were contacted by an irrigation worker with a chilling story.
He was clearing irrigation canals, and he discovers this girl in this culvert that goes under the roadway.
Responding officers fear that the body that had been discovered was going to be Vicky Ramirez.
When that call came in, patrol responded and secured the scene, and then they called detectives.
She was partially dressed. She had a piece of fabric tied around her neck. It was described as being a infant bedsheet or blanket with teddy bears.
But it was the victim's shirt that convinced Detective Mike Boudreau that the search for Vicky Ramirez had just ended in the worst way possible.
We've been searching for this young lady, and then when you're standing there and you're looking down into this water ditch, you know it's her. That image has never left my brain. Still, even when I'm talking to you about it, I can clearly see it in my memory.
Detectives knew that they now had the worst job in law enforcement in front of them. Notifying a desperate mother that her daughter would never be coming home. Vicky's sister, Michaela Pace.
I remember her dropping to her knees and just crying. Just crying. And then I knew something horrible had happened to my sister.
Vicky's mother, Angelica Ramirez.
She's dead. And I never see her again. She was a wonderful, wonderful girl. Why did this happen to her?
Watching Vicky's heartbroken family absorb the devastating news steeled the resolve of every detective on the case.
What terror this young lady must have gone through, there's no other way to describe it but a monster took the life out of this young lady. Seeing her lay there, that memory is what carried me over the years to never let go. Man, I wanted to put him behind bars.
While police continued to search for the two people witnesses saw fleeing the swap meet with a child, the Vicky Ramirez missing persons case had just become a homicide investigation. That meant answering questions about how two strangers could have gotten the 10-year-old to the parking lot a top priority. Detectives look for clues along the route from the women's bathroom to where her shoe prints ended in the parking lot.
It's roughly 75 yards from the bathroom to the west entrance. Then you gotta cross the two-lane road and then into the parking structure. So she probably walked a good 200 yards.
Investigators were at a loss as to how the abductors were able to win Vicky's trust and lead her to the car. Detectives also wondered about the desolate area where the child's body was recovered. It was nowhere near the swap meet.
Unless you were out running irrigation or running equipment on the farmland, there was really no reason for anyone to be out there.
Detectives believe that the killer had to have been someone familiar with the area to know where the culvert was located.
It's a very secluded area. It's not something that the general public would have knowledge of.
Investigators hope that Vicky's autopsy might give them a lead. The medical examiner's report painted a horrific picture of the girl's last moments alive.
She died from strangulation, and she was sexually assaulted. There was a minute amount of DNA that was salvaged.
The ME believed the killer had used the piece of fabric with the teddy bears on it to strangle Vicky. It was an odd choice and could have only come from one place.
We believed it came from the suspect.
As news spread throughout the community about Vicky's abduction and murder, everyone was shocked, saddened, and scared.
It was heart-wrenching. We're a community who wants to be safe in their schools, we want to be safe at our parks, we want to be safe in our churches. And this sent a fear into a community that, in fact, maybe this isn't the case.
The community's fear quickly translated into action. Investigators received dozens of tips on the information they had distributed to the media.
In the reports, there was a for sale sign on the side of the Isuzu. A construction worker observed this Isuzu at a construction site. The owner resembled the male from the sketch.
Investigators impounded the car and brought the owners in for questioning. And a search of the car revealed something alarming.
They had located a firearm under the driver's seat. The driver of the vehicle was arrested. He was interviewed, and it turned out that they were at the swap meet. It was their Isuzu that witnesses saw. And there was a child in the back that was screaming.
In fact, the only thing the suspect denied was that the screaming child was Vicky Ramirez.
It ended up being his niece, and the female ended up being the suspect's sister.
The man answered every question police asked him.
Both him and his entire family were extremely cooperative with investigators.
In the end, there was nothing that connected either the man nor his sister to the crime scene.
we were able to rule them out as being involved.
It was a disappointing setback, but the sheriff's department continued to get flooded with tips.
We were getting phone calls from people that had reported observing a suspicious male loitering around the bathroom that made them feel uncomfortable. It was even to the point to where family members were calling in and reporting other family members.
There was hundreds and hundreds of leads.
But none advanced the investigation. And that left law enforcement fearful that the dangerous predator who had murdered Vicky Ramirez would strike again. More than a year passed, and detectives grew frustrated by their lack of progress. The case was at a standstill.
I don't want to say it was cold, because the investigators were constantly following up on some lead, but we just didn't have anything promising.
And just when investigators thought they might never get that elusive break they were hoping for, a call came in from Kings County law enforcement.
Kings County was investigating another rape homicide of a Hispanic female that was the same age as Vicky. And they had identified Gene McCurdy as the suspect in their case. They had an extremely strong case against him. They were reaching out due to the similarities of their investigation. McCurdy could have been responsible for Vicky.
As investigators pored over the case file, several details jumped off the page. Gene McCurdy had been charged with abducting an 8-year-old girl from outside a crowded market. And following her murder, the 34-year-old Navy officer had disposed of her body in a shallow creek. Investigators were determined to find out if McCurdy had also been responsible for the sadistic crime against Vicky.
My gut instinct was that these are too similar in nature. It has to be connected.
When detectives learned that McCurdy had been stationed at Leemore Navy Base around the time of Vicky's murder, they became convinced.
They did find ties to McCurdy being in Tulare County in late 93, early 94.
We thought, this is our break. We felt that we have our man.
Detectives went to speak with Gene McCurdy.
It was an odd interview. He was making statements that he was responsible for Vicky's abduction and death, but wouldn't give any details. He made some requests to see a mental health professional so he could unlock the suppressed memories of what he did to Vicky.
McCurdy also expressed remorse for his actions.
He ended up writing an apology letter to Angelica. He said, "I am apologizing, but I'm not ready to deal with what I did to your daughter."
We were hoping that the guilt of what had taken place brought him forward to tell the truth.
Still, detectives on the case remained troubled by McCurdy's story.
He began slipping up a little bit in the interview. Investigators even said in debriefings, "This guy is not telling us things that he should know. It's not adding up."
In fact, McCurdy didn't seem aware of the intimate details of the crime.
He didn't provide any specific details whatsoever.
Nagging doubts led investigators to dig deeper into McCurdy's past, and a check of his military records led to a devastating discovery.
We were able to confirm that he was in fact on base in Washington, where he was stationed the day that she was taken.
It turned out that McCurdy had only been transferred to the base in Lemoore weeks after Vicky's murder. And the physical evidence confirmed investigators' worst fears.
Unfortunately, the small DNA sample that we had did not match up. We eliminated him. He couldn't have done the crime.
Investigators could only speculate as to why he confessed to a murder that he didn't commit.
When we have false confessions, it's generally someone's wanting credit for something. Me being a sane person, I don't understand why you would want to take credit for the abduction, raping, and killing of a 10-year-old.
McCurdy was ultimately convicted of the incredibly similar crime in Kings County and sentenced to death. But detectives on the Vicky Ramirez case were back to square one.
Which was disheartening to say the least.
It would be nearly 2 years until police received their next big break on the case from an inmate named Donald Bales.
He had told jail staff that he wanted to speak with investigators about Vicky's case and that he had information about that case.
Investigators sat down with Bales for a tape-recorded interview.
I went to the flea market, looking around. I seen the girl.
Bales had been at the swap meet the day that Vicky went missing.
When you got to the swap meet, did you talk to her?
She asked me if I could help her to find her parents. She wandered off from her parents.
What was she wearing?
The white shirt with a picture on it.
You know what kind of picture it was?
Had a little, like a little animal on it.
As police listened to the details of Bale's terrifying abduction, no one could have imagined that the most shocking part of his story was still ahead.
He proceeded to tell investigators this story of how he was directly involved in the abduction and murder of Vicky.
Tell me what happened. How did you get her into the car? Look at me, Donald.
I forced her.
How did you do that?
I grabbed her arm, her left arm.
What did she do?
She screamed.
What was she saying?
She said, let me go.
What did you tell her?
I told her no, and it got out of control.
Bales claimed that after he forced the child into his car, he drove her to a desolate stretch of farmland where the attack continued.
Got her out of the car and I forced myself onto her.
Was she struggling?
Yes. She told me to leave her alone.
How did you keep her from struggling?
I choked her to death.
What did you do then?
I picked her up and I put her in the canal.
Bale's confession was chilling, and it lined up with the evidence found at the crime scene. Still, investigators weren't convinced.
He had a lot of information, but what he had was mostly what was in the newspaper. And that is why, in law enforcement, we don't tell the media everything.
In Vicky's case, the details police withheld were about the murder weapon.
How did you choke her?
I put some kind of rope around her throat.
We knew that she wasn't strangled with a rope. She had a piece of fabric tied around her neck. A softer fabric with teddy bears.
Police then gave Bales a second chance to remember the item he used to kill Vicky.
Where did you get the thing that you strangled her with?
It was on the side of the road. Got that plastic bag, put it around her throat, and choked her to death.
His story was changing and not making sense. I really didn't know what to think.
Investigators brought Bales to the area where Vicky's body had been recovered. And those doubts grew.
He couldn't point out the exact location that she was located.
Then came the final blow. DNA testing confirmed that Donald Bales had lied about his role in Vicky's murder.
Ultimately, we were able to rule Bales out as a suspect.
We were able to show, in fact, there's no way he could have committed this crime.
Detectives felt a sense of dread for the second time since the case began. They had another false confession.
Shocking. Shocking to have two false confessions. Talk about having your balloon deflated.
I just couldn't believe it. I cannot wrap my head around why someone would confess to something as heinous as what this case was.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. The false confessions left Vicky's family in shambles. Vicky's sister, Michaela Pace.
I didn't think they were ever going to find out who did it. I didn't think we were ever going to get answers. It was just like, it's been so long. What other leads can they have? How would they get more information? My mom kept us super secluded from everyone. We weren't allowed to ever go out of her sight.
Vicky's mother, Angelica Ramirez.
I was very scared because we don't know who was responsible. Yeah, it was very, very scary.
The unsolved murder haunted Detective Mike Boudreau, even after his superiors urged him to move on. This time, the investigation was officially declared cold.
That never rested well with me. I always had the binder on my desk. I won't be able to let go of it.
In 2015, 21 years after Vicky's murder, Mike Boudreau was elected sheriff of Tulare County. And that meant there was no one who could stop him from reopening the case.
That's when we assigned Sergeant Lowry. I wanted a fresh new feel. I wanted a firecracker, new young detective to come in and tell me something new.
Sergeant Lowry started his investigation from scratch. For the young detective, one trip to the evidence locker left him as committed to justice as Sheriff Boudreau. Detective Josh Lowry.
This is the shirt investigators found on Vicky's body 2 days later after she went missing from the swap meet. Looking at this shirt, it really hits home. Because I could see my daughter wearing something like this. You can't comprehend why someone would want to do what they did to a little 10-year-old girl. And just seeing the shirt, it's gut-wrenching. It really just kind of adds that extra motivation to keep pushing through.
Sergeant Lowry hoped that advancements in DNA science might lead him to Vicky's killer.
We had a good DNA sample from our suspect, but our suspect had never been arrested before. It wasn't in the CODIS database. And genealogy was really going to be the only way we could identify him.
Sergeant Lowry spent the next 3 years painstakingly eliminating potential suspects through DNA.
I just kept building family trees on the data that was given until I came across a name that fit. It fit the puzzle.
It was a name that had never been mentioned in the case file before.
Romero Villegas.
Sergeant Lowry started digging into Villegas' history.
It was a hard background to put together, but we knew he had immigrated from Mexico to the States. Sometime in the late 80s, he moved up here to Tulare County. He was living a couple miles from where Vicky was found.
And a deep dive into Villegas' past convinced Sergeant Lowry that he was the man who abducted and killed Vicky Ramirez.
During further investigation into Romero Villegas and interviewing his longtime girlfriend and family members, we had discovered that he had a long history of sexual molestation of minors.
Sadly, none of those attacks had been reported to police before now. Still, Villegas did have a criminal record following Vicky's murder.
He was sentenced to prison for drug sales, running a drug house, possession of a firearm. He had served roughly 2 years for that prison sentence, and then he was immediately deported upon his release from prison. From what we could tell, he never came back into the States.
Sergeant Lowry contacted Mexican authorities about the possibility of bringing Villegas back to the U.S. to face murder charges and made a crushing discovery.
He came in to tell me we had good news and bad news. I said, well, give me the good news. We've identified who our suspect is. I was thrilled. The bad news is that he had died 10 years prior.
While solving the case was their ultimate goal, investigators had a hard time accepting that Villegas wouldn't have to face justice for his unthinkable crime.
It's very difficult because I wanted him to sit in my jail.
The sheriff also knew he would need to break the news to Vicky's family.
We brought him into the office to have a conversation, and I explained to the family that I had good news and I had bad news.
The day before, they showed me a picture, and they say, hey, that's the guy. He's responsible for Vicky. And I go, okay, where he at? Where he at? I want to see him. And they say, he's gone. He's dead already. I go, no, no. It's horrible and it's very painful. I want justice.
I am very thankful that they gave us a name. And we know that we don't have to look over our shoulders anymore. It was kind of like a bittersweet feeling. I was happy up until they told me he was dead. Then I felt like he gets off the easy way.
Michaela is angry that Villegas will never be held to account for what he did to Vicky.
He just got to live his normal life. Like nothing. Like what he did meant nothing to him. Is he a psycho or something? Because I don't understand how a person can go on living their life like nothing, treated someone like nothing, and just goes the next day and lives their own life like normal. I don't understand.
Despite the disappointing ending to the case, Vicky's family has tremendous gratitude for all the members of law enforcement who never gave up on finding Vicky's killer.
I'm very thankful. I'm glad they just keep working. They did a great job. Great job.
I'm very thankful for them. I'm very thankful that she wasn't just a lost case, a cold case just thrown in the back of a box in a storage room. I'm very grateful to them and that they kept on and they never forgot about her.
The family maybe didn't have their justice, but they did, in fact, have peace.
After 28 years of torment, Vicky's loved ones were finally able to grieve her death without doubts.
Losing a daughter, losing a child, it's something that you're never gonna forget. You're never gonna replace one, no matter what.
It's hard to go from one day to another without her. But I believe my sister's gone to a better place. My sister's up in heaven, looking down on us and giving us strength to carry on. I love her, and I hope to see her one day.
Sheriff Mike Boudreau hopes that Vicky's family won't be the last one his team helps. His cold case unit remains hard at work trying to close other unsolved homicides. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.